We left off some of our introductions. Are there still some devotees who have information from which to give introductions and who haven't spoken? Ajit Prabhu. What are you? And Bharat Prabhu.
Hare Krishna, welcome to our program. Today we have a special guest from France. His name is Vasudev Prabhu. He will speak on the subject of India's devotional culture. And I think most of you have come in contact with this movement here in the West may not know so much or not even be aware of our very rich religious and cultural heritage in India. So Vasudev Prabhu was previously a student of philosophy at the University of Montpellier in southern France. For almost 10 years now, he has been practicing, living, preaching this culture. And in the last 2 years, he has extensively traveled in India, in southern India, in West Bengal, in the Himalayas, to make video documentary films on India's devotional culture. He's completed 4 such films and is now working on a film about the holy places of Vrindavan, which is the most sacred area in India where Krishna himself appeared and performed his transcendental pastimes 5,000 years ago. And this film will be distributed to cultural institutions and television networks worldwide. So let us hear Vasudev Prabhu.
Thank you. Some response?
That was very attractive, very attractive. Mm. Cultural attention.
Other response? Arjun Prabhu.
Well, I thought everything was good except his head kept on going in the swan's rhythm. And it kind of distracted me a little bit.
Okay.
Yeah, I would like to give a sermon on the Ramanuja Prabhu. It's kind of much more nervous speaking to this audience than
in general. I know I've heard Ajit Prabhu speak in Sweden, and it's harder here. How did that compare with... So today, we're going to hear from Vasudev Prabhu. He's a very senior devotee in our movement. And he's very sincere and very learned also. So I'm sure he'll have many interesting things to say. We hope you'll all give careful attention to Vasudev Prabhu. That's where we started off. So I think we've come quite a good way. Bharat Prabhu? I could give another comment though. Your order was more or less temporal. This happened and then that happened. He went from Montpellier to being a devotee for 10 years. Sometimes I found that the direction wasn't going consistently. He was going to talk about Vedic culture. Then we went backwards to his being in France. Then we went forward to his being last three years in India. And I think if the order had been... had pulled related things together, it would have been still stronger.
Was I supposed to talk about Vedic culture?
That was the topic.
Isn't that very general?
But that's the topic, given topic. And very often topics are chosen to be quite general, and then the responsibility is on the speaker to make it specific. We don't want to give you a topic, Vedic culture in the late 19th century of Karnataka. And we may not know what you want to speak on, so we make a broad topic, and then you choose that topic and hone it down. It's very nice. All right, Prabhu.
Hare Krishna, Prabhu. Today we'll hear from Mudas. He's coming from Stockholm, Sweden, and he'll talk to us about the importance of cooperating with each other, and also he will speak to us about the necessity of doing the needful in Krishna service. He's been a devotee for 9 years, and he's done different services for Prabhupada's movement, and he's worked with different devotees in Finland, Denmark, Sweden. So he'll just tell us about his experiences with working with different devotees and how it was very important, how it is very important to cooperate with each other.
Thank you. Some feedback? Yes.
Well, perhaps you didn't get enough information from the devotee, but things like different devotees and different services are real general, aren't you doing kind of specific to that answer?
I felt the same way, there wasn't enough detail.
Yeah. How was the sheet that you got?
You gave more details, so I guess I didn't need some.
Details are effective. When we heard about Vasudev Prabhu, when we heard details, he'd been 3 years here, and we don't know what Montpellier University is. I have no idea if that's France or Switzerland, or Canada for that matter. But just the fact that it was a specific indicates that Ajit knows about what he did, and that if I'm not impressed, I ought to be impressed. Facts have power. So if you can give not just various different places for several years, but Canada, Switzerland, and southern France for the past 4.5 years, there's a big difference. Details, facts. Yeah. I was really glad when you let your hands go. You were like this, which is good way to start. And if you're going to freeze your hands, freeze them that way. But I felt a lot more comfortable when you unfroze them and became natural with them. And then your movements were very expressive. It was good. Okay? Yes?
Would it be appropriate if the speaker is going to have a specific topic, the introduction may cover fully that topic or a topic related to the topic without saying almost anything about whatever else the devotee may have done, and would it be alright? You give all kinds of specifics, but in one area of his long career.
I see. We can do both things. If the topic is quite specific, and particularly if the audience is expecting a learned presentation on that topic, then you really might want to emphasize the person's qualifications. If, on the other hand, it's one out of many possible topics, and the person is quite distinguished in many fields, then you might want to refer to that. You might say something, apart from having spent the last 3 years in Calcutta doing research for the Bhaktivedanta Institute, he's also traveled all over the world. He spent 3 years in Africa, 2 years in France, 4 years doing undergraduate studies at Harvard University, and so on and so on and so on, apart from his expertise in today's topic. Sure. Sure. Okay. Making your meaning clear. Yes? Is my sheet there? No. Yes. First point, try for it. That means hear your own words and mentally check with yourself and ask yourself, are people going to understand what I'm saying? And if not, make it clearer, make it plainer, explain it. That means, first of all, you have to know what it is you're trying to say. You have to have your thoughts organized. And then you try to see how to make that as direct and to the point as possible. We've got a kind of bad training in public education, in modern days especially, by which we think the more elegant the language, or the more upper the language, the better our presentation is, whether it's in writing or it's in speech. Exactly the opposite is true. The more clear, the more plain, the more simple, and the more direct you can make it, the better your writing will be, and the better your speaking will be. Here's an example. Those who are in the writing, who are in Purujan Prabhu's writing class, will recall this example. Here's a modern English sentence. Objective consideration of contemporary phenomena compels the conclusion that success or failure in competitive activities exhibits no tendency to be commensurate with innate capacity, but that a considerable element of the unpredictable must invariably be taken into account. Now, it's perfectly grammatical English, and it all means something. Here's the same message from the book of Ecclesiastes. I returned and saw under the sun that the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, neither yet bread to the wise, nor yet riches to men of understanding, nor yet favor to men of skill, but time and chance happeneth to them all. Is that clearer? It ought to be. Specifics. Things you can get your hands on. I returned and I saw under the sun that the race is not to the swift, nor bread to the wise, and so on. Pictures. Not success or failure in competitive activities exhibits no tendency to be commensurate with innate capacity. All vagaries, all abstractions, all Latin. Competitive activities exhibits no tendency. Straight, clear, easily understandable words, and especially words that make pictures, will get your meaning across. It doesn't have to be five-syllable words. In fact, the most effective writing makes use of one-syllable words, two-syllable words, predominating. Occasional three-syllable. And then when you throw seven syllables at them, it's really going to have punch. Shakespeare does that. He'll take very simple words and stick a Latin four-syllable word between them. And it really has punch when he does it. Because it's intentional. Okay? If you use technical terms, especially Sanskrit terms, or in terms, terms that mean things to ISKCON but don't mean things to other people, explain them. I was in ISKCON for a week before I was able to figure out what ISKCON was. Everyone was talking about ISKCON. What's ISKCON? So we're very pleased to have you today in our ISKCON temple. What's ISKCON? If you use a term, explain it. What is Brahman? What is Paramatma? And the best way to explain something is with a clear example that relates to things people already know. And we have so many good examples from Prabhupada, we should have no trouble. You don't have to make up new ones. We know some people whose claim to fame, practically, was their ability to come up with newer and newer and newer examples. New analogies, new explanations. Okay, but we're more impressed by your ability to repeat the standard examples. So I've given the example many times, just as the hand puts food in the stomach. So we have to give our energy to Krishna. So many good examples are there that people can instantly grasp and that you're sure about. You don't have to wonder if your analogy is maybe a little funny or if you're going to have to pat. You don't have to have your mind keeping track of your analogy. You can keep your mind on the philosophy and you already have right in hand a simple way to say it. Now you may also, from your practical experience, come up with a good illustration, a good instance, a good example. But our main duty is to be using the examples that we've received to transmit the same meaning. Otherwise, you come up with a fancy example. Somebody hears it in your class, he starts giving the same fancy example. plus he has a few fancy examples of his own. Pretty soon, watering the root of the tree and feeding, putting the food in the stomach have completely dropped out of sight, and you've got all sorts of new examples out of nowhere that no one's ever heard any before. And sakala neha mahata yoganashta prantipa. That's how the message and its method of transmission gets lost. So we have these great examples, great stories. The sun, the sunshine, the sun planet, the sun globe. There's no clearer way to say that. You may give another example, you may help amplify it. Prabhupada would sometimes give a new example. But really use these examples that Prabhupada's given us. They help make things crystal clear instantly. They also make people feel comfortable with your lectures. They don't worry about you. Where did he get that from?
Sometimes there's a tendency when you're talking to devotees, if you want to say something they haven't heard before, to get their interest. And whereas you're talking to, say, some people at the university who haven't heard the philosophy before, then you feel confident just repeating the same things. But
you know, my experience is a little different. I find that devotees, by and large, are sick of hearing new things. That they really would like to hear good, solid, you can bet your money on it, parampara preaching. Especially given recent history over the past 10 years, they really would like to know that they're on good, solid ground, that the person who's giving the Bhagavatam class is speaking the same thing that Prabhupada said. They really start feeling comfortable and happy and confident about it. And when they hear your new examples and your new ways of saying it and everybody reinventing the wheel, they just doubt whether it's another inspiration, another realization. We're tired of realizations. We're tired of inspirations. We want substance. So yes, if you really have a striking way of seeing something that amplifies the already existing example, if you're catching someone's attention by giving new life, as it were. Like Prabhupada, there's a banyan tree in Calcutta Botanical Gardens which is said to be 5,000 years old. It's a practical example. It's a practical example. So just as one has to put food in the stomach, I had practical experience that I was being fed intravenously, but that amplifies the already existing example, perhaps makes it more memorable or draws people's attention more. But really what you want to do is focus on your bread and butter. Spread out the bread and butter and feed people that. They don't want to see what new thing came out of the factory of the mind today. I do it, and then the next man does it, and pretty soon you've got a week's worth of Bhagavatam classes with hardly any Bhagavatam, but just with everybody trying to be innovative. Competitively innovative. Who can say the newest thing in the most snappy way? Don't. Keep it simple. Okay? That would be my advice. Is your experience the same when you're listening to classes? I'm getting a lot of nods. Yes. I feel very happy when I hear someone saying the same old thing, especially if he's actually thought about the subject and realized it, and he can bring in different old verses. Kripaniti Prabhu gave a class a few days ago. Everyone, what did you think of that class? When he started quoting verses, oh, it's nice, I thought. Whenever a new verse came that I hadn't heard for a long time or that I'd half forgotten, I was impressed. He just had a stock of good examples and good things to say just from the scriptures. There's no limit. Lots of times we're turning to new examples because we don't know the old ones. That's what happens too often. Okay, any questions? More? Good. This is a quickie. But there's one point I don't want to leave out. Don't try to cover too many points. That's a really good way of becoming obscure. You're jumping around like one of those sparrows in the building, from here to there to here to there, and no one can really grasp on to any one of the points you're making. Better to take one point, make it clear, Go on to the next point. Make it clear. Don't belabor it. But spend enough time. Okay. Yes, we do have a little bit of time. I don't know how far we're going to get. Yes?
I just wanted to make clear exactly what you were speaking against, because there's some concept also, like we're talking about in our writing class, when someone becomes Krishna conscious, his mind starts to become active.
Mm.
And he starts to see the philosophy in his ordinary day-to-day observations. Also the fact that realization means the ability to communicate.
Yes.
So you may be in so many different circumstances, and you may do something contemporary.
Yes.
Which Prabhupada always did also. Now, so...
Where do you draw the line?
Yeah, and there are some people that do give interesting examples that...
Well, Srila Prabhupada would tell us, find new lights in the purport. While discussing the books or reading the books, try and find new lights in the purport. That means that the anchor or the substance is the purport and the verse. And what we're saying should really illuminate the philosophy. It shouldn't be an excursion far afield. If you have an experience or an example that really does make things clear or attract the mind to understand it, that's fine. And it's desirable. Sukadev Goswami wasn't just a parrot, but he was able to present the thing with realization for the understanding of the audience. And Srila Prabhupada was also. You brought up his example, that he give this kind of practical experience or a practical example. But what proportion of his talks consisted of that? And what proportion consisted of just direct transmission of what's there in the Shastras or what's there from the previous Acharyas? Right? So a little chutney is not bad. It makes a little pickle, a little chutney, gives things a little zing, adds a little zing to the meal, gives a little taste. But if you sit down for lunch and it's all chutney and pickle, people are going to start missing the dal, rice, and chapatis. We eat dal, rice, and chapatis. Some sabji, little chutney, little pickle, little salt. But if it's all salt and pickle and chutney, forget it.
Maharaj, would it be right to say that this principle you've mentioned is more important in regard to analogies rather than sometimes giving examples of stories?
Anything. You can get off on... I know people who tell a story, they get on a story, by the time the story's over, you've heard the whole Merchant of Venice. And it was all for one little point that could have been told in 3 minutes from Srimad Bhagavatam. You can misuse stories, analogies, comparisons, analysis, anything, just by becoming puffed up and more fascinated by what you can do than with what your purpose is. We should keep our purpose in mind. We're transmitters. You're being paid to stand up there. You're being asked to speak because we have confidence that you can transmit the message of the Acharyas. That's what you're supposed to do. If you can do that, if you don't say a single new thing, if there's not a single innovation, if all you did was repeat what you heard, it's a success. Now, if you can present it in an interesting way with some examples from your personal experience and some depth of realization, so much better. But if it becomes all realization and hardly any Bhagavatam, hardly any substance, hardly any transmission, then it's a question of whether the glasses are magnifying or making things opaque. Your examples or your personal contribution should magnify the subject, clarify the subject, not bring opacity. Okay. Diction. Quick. Awful sounding space fillers. We dealt with some of them previously, so we can dump them right now. The ubiquitous you know, really. Here's, I mean, That's another one. A particular one that's coming up lately in ISKCON is this one.
Lately?
I mean, that's just not how things go, isn't it? You understand what I mean? It's just not the proper way to act, isn't it? Isn't it works this way? It is clear, isn't it? The it refers to the previous it. It is simple, isn't it? But they're really crazy, isn't it? What's the it refer to? I suppose what it means is, isn't it so? Isn't it so? And if that's what you mean, say so. It only takes one syllable, and it helps people from thinking that you're crazy, isn't it? I find myself succumbing to it lately, isn't it? Watch out, it's just a way to make no sense and waste your time. Like the parenthetical, like I said, it's really the kind of thing where drop the likes, edit them out, and one more that's really caught on, two more. Oh, here's two more. One is just like, when you're not doing a comparison, or it just starts, the sentence just starts, just like, and there's nothing that you're likening anything to. Just like should introduce a comparison. Otherwise, drop it and start your sentence after just like. And another one, like that. So we have to understand that kirtan, bhajan, prasadam, studying the scriptures, like that. So in this way we have to go on. Not that we waste our time with television and movies and so many things like that. Drop the like that. Just silence. Observe a moment of silent meditation instead. It's better than like that. Any questions? Good. Now, I want to move back. Although I gave out the sheets for the famous ad hominem form of argument, I want to move back a little bit to our previous discussion of authority, which, after all, is a most important topic. I'm going to set my clock first. Okay. Authority, as we were discussing, is a way of invoking prestige for your argument. Sometimes that's an extremely legitimate thing to do. In law, so much of the argument depends upon appeals to authority. Whichever lawyer presents the best precedent wins the case. And you'll find very often that when you're discussing some topic, different sides will bring different arguments from authority. All good arguments, all backed up by authority. Then you have a good case on each side and you have to judge it. It's not fallacious. But there may also be false appeals to authority. False credentials. Here's a letter from Srila Prabhupada to someone who had written him with some complaints from New York. You write as doctor. Please let me know what kind of doctor you are. Have you got any bona fide certificate? Send me the copy of the certificate. People lie about their credentials. They bluff. Doctor such and such. Doctor of what? Doctorate from where? What's your field? What's your specialty? Doctor. We're very impressed that you're a doctor, but your medical doctorate doesn't do a thing when we're discussing architecture. Or none of your mundane credentials do anything when we're talking about Vedic literature. We can point that out. We want a person who's got a doctorate from Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. When it comes to understanding Bhagavad Gita, no amount of mundane credentials will be helpful. Okay? Prestige backed by pseudo-technical jargon. A person starts talking in big, big words that no one can follow, or at least that you can't follow. And what's the result? I start thinking, boy, I must be really dense. Wow, he's over my head. I don't really know what he's talking about. He gotcha. He used the words deliberately because he was trying to intimidate you. Anyone who's an expert, anyone who's an authority, anyone who understands the meaning of such technical terms ought to be able to explain himself clearly to you. He ought to be able to explain himself. If he just talked about the importance of hermeneutics in understanding this question, admit it, you're stupid, you don't know what hermeneutics is. Ask him. What is this hermeneutics and how does it apply? I'm sorry, I'm not familiar with that term. Could you explain what you mean? If he can't, then he's bluffing. He doesn't know what it means. He heard someone say it sounded good. He doesn't know what hermeneutics is. Or he has a vague idea, but he doesn't know how it really applies. Let them make it clear to you. If they can't make it clear to you, don't believe them. I'm sorry, I just can't follow what you're saying. It doesn't make sense to me. Sometimes there's a legitimate reason to use technical words, because they're the only words that clearly explain it. Or because your audience thinks, actually, in terms of that technical language, which to them makes sense. There are times to use technical language. But too often it's simply used to impress, to intimidate, to bamboozle. If you suspect that that trick is being pulled on you, just say, I'm sorry. Ask that it be explained. Don't be afraid to show your ignorance. Show it. Broadcast it. Flaunt it. I'm sorry, I just don't understand the meaning of these words. Could you explain it in a simple way so that even I could understand? Because otherwise, how can we go on talking? Flaunt your ignorance. It's great. The authority of other scriptures. I'll offer my personal point of view, which you can challenge or take as it is. When people come up with evidence from the Bible or from other scriptures, my suggestion is that you plead ignorance. My suggestion is plead ignorance. Well, I'm sorry, I don't know very much about the Bible, but we're speaking from Bhagavad Gita, and the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says. Why? First of all, there's a good chance that whatever little argument you may bring up about the Bible will be completely knocked out, because this man knows the Bible backwards, forwards, and inside out. If you meet a really good Christian, he can quote you passage after passage after passage. In fact, Srila Prabhupada said, we should know the Bhagavad Gita the way the Christians know the Bible. Inside and out. These people wear out their Bibles reading them. They just go through two or three or four of them. Wear them down. And they'll wear you down too. So avoid that. You become like the crocodile on the land or the elephant in the water. You're out of your territory. You're on their territory. Now you've got to deal with their arguments, their authorities, their positions and counterpositions. Yes?
Right. When you show ignorance of your knowledge of that particular scripture, then they'll argue with you that, well, how do you know what you're following is the best? You haven't really examine various scriptures.
Have you examined the... Have you read Gilgamesh? Have you read the Tibetan Book of the Dead? I'm sorry, I can't read all the religious literature of the world. I'm reading Bhagavad Gita, and I can speak to you about Bhagavad Gita. I'm not an expert in comparative religion, I'm sorry. But from Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says this.
In Bengal, we are preaching, and many persons, they say, have you heard about Ramakrishna? And you say, I'm a member of the International Center for Krishna Consciousness, whatever I know, and I have from my spiritual master.
Right.
And it's a good point, because then they, Ramakrishna say this. They say, actually, in Bhagavad Gita, it is not mentioned.
Yeah. I don't know what he may say, but in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says this. Then you're right, that's the next result. You're right back on your own turf. Instead of talking about Paul and Peter and this one and that one, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, you're talking about Krishna again. You're right back on the territory where you're strongest and where you're saying what you want to say. You don't have to listen to a whole batch of arguments that you didn't really come to talk about. You're back on your own territory.
How do you deal if you ask some person who didn't accept for the Christian and didn't accept your argument from the Bhagavad Gita, but always goes quoting the Bible? So how do you deal with that?
Well, there are different ways you can approach. One is just cite logic. If he doesn't accept from the Vedic literature that killing animals is barbaric, give him a good example. He says the animals have no soul. Then give him logic. Animals eat, we eat. Animals have feelings, we have feelings. Animal has sex, we have sex. Animals sleep, we sleep. Animals have family affection, we have family affection. So many points of similarity are there. How can you say the animal has no soul? You don't have to say, well, in the Bible, two hooves or cloven hoof or hook together. You can say, this is simple compassion. The animal is also a living being. We have feelings, the animal has feelings. Why should we kill the animal? In fact, in the Vedic literature, it said that the animals are also the children of God. It's reasonable. Yeah, you may not know so many things about Vedic literature, but it's simple common sense. Appeal to his common sense. Because Vedic literature is sensible. He may not know what it says, but when he hears it, he should recognize common sense when he hears it. So you can argue in that way.
Nobody said, well, I don't know Bible so much, but I believe the Bible, the task and so. And I tell you, why don't you read Bible?
I've read it, but I just can't. I'm not an expert in the Bible. I can't speak from the Bible. It's very nice, but I just don't know very much about it. And another advantage of that is that if you do have something strong to say from the Bible, then it's that much more powerful, because you don't know anything about the Bible. But it seems to me that Peter said that if you judge something without knowing what it is, that's less intelligent. There's some quotation from Chronicles or someplace where one of the apostles said that to judge a thing without considering it is foolish. So you can admit complete ignorance. I don't really know which book it's in or which apostle said it, but it seems to me it's in the Bible. You're the Christian. You take a look and see if you find it. You just throw that point right out, and it's a strong point, and it came from ignorant you, who admitted in advance he didn't know anything from the Bible. You just throw that one out and go right back to Bhagavad Gita. So just give me a hearing. Just give me a hearing. Don't judge me in advance. Just consider what Krishna said. Or, I don't know very much about the Bible, but in the Bible, doesn't Jesus also say, thou shalt not kill? Find out from him. Does he say it or not? He's the authority in Christianity. Does Christ say that? Then why are you killing? And when he gives you another, and apostles this, 2 Corinthians that, well, I don't know very much about the Bible, but it's common sense. Jesus said, thou shalt not kill. And you stick on your point. Any further questions on this? Otherwise, I've seen so many devotees who want to show off their stuff, that they've got a good argument from the Bible, and as soon as they put their little hand in the water, you know, the crocodile grabs their hand, and then they're three quarters in.
That means even if you know something, it's better not to...
That's my advice. Even if you do know a whole batch of stuff, your mother raised you on Bible stories, avoid it. We have better things to say.
What about using "thou shalt not kill"?
Fine, it's solid.
But then the argument that generally comes up is that, well, animals, they may do everything that humans do if they're not as intelligent as human beings. And on top of that, God gave man dominion over animals.
Well, I've got a couple arguments for that. Prabhupada has an argument for less intelligent. So if your brother is less intelligent, you kill him? You don't have to argue that on the Bible. That's common sense. So if your brother is less intelligent, you should kill him? And dominion over the animals, these are specific arguments. Dominion means what? Comes from dominus, lord, or king. God made man the lord, or the king, over the animals. Now, what kind of king is it who slits the throats of the citizens? Is that your idea of executing the responsibility that God gave you? He made you king over the animals, and you're going to kill them? He gave you dominion, and that's what you do when you get some little responsibility from God? How do you expect to go to the kingdom of God, where He's king, when He gives you a little responsibility, and that's what you do with it? He gives you a few little animals to take care of, and you slit their throats and eat them. Is that your idea of being a king or a lord? Or our Vedic philosophy is that the king is the protector of the citizens. In fact, Maharaj Yudhisthira, he saw one man beating a cow, and he immediately challenged him, "I'll kill you. This can't happen in my kingdom." He didn't make this distinction between human subjects and non-human subjects. They were all entitled to protection under the state. This is real spiritual civilization. You don't have to touch the Bible. Common sense and Vedic authority. That's my personal recommendation. And that's what we saw with Srila Prabhupada. He didn't waste a lot of time on subtle biblical arguments. And I've seen so many devotees get snowed under.
I heard a tape just recently where Prabhupada explained it in Scottish Rite's college. When he went there, he took a half an hour Bible class every day. Mm. So he knew the Bible.
Yeah.
Something.
Yeah.
And still he didn't go.
Yeah. If you happen to have gone to divinity school, and you're really expert in the Bible, that's another story. If you're really expert, and you want to throw some stuff at him, and you're really on sure ground, you know that when it comes to him or you, you're going to beat the pants off him, whether it's the Bible or any other book, go ahead. But otherwise, just common Joe devotee with some Christian background, stay away. And even if you have been to divinity school, throw them a punch from the Bible, then throw them five from Bhagavad Gita. Okay. Any other questions? Yes.
What about punching on all the weak points, like, for example, about meat eating, or like that spirit mastering is set in karma, and then you can just go on?
What?
Like, what about, preaching on one point, like, it's very weak in Christian concept, for example, like
meeting
or for some other instances when...
Is that what Prabhupada did?
Well, yeah.
So you can do it too. Take a point and stick on it. Sure. And one other point. We were talking about appeals to conventional wisdom as a kind of authority. A stitch in time saves nine. There are other kinds of common knowledge. The Russians are out to take over the world. The big corporations are corrupt, or whatever. There's so many kinds of things that everybody knows. Watch out for that stuff. It tends to be muddy thinking. It's, if you read in, let's see, do I have a chapter? Chapter 31, Straight and Crooked Thinking. If you read about predigested thinking, it's very instructive. That's another reason for my animosity toward Time magazine. When you read it, you get a whole batch of Gerber's baby food. It's already been ground up and turned into pablum. You don't have to think about any of it because all the thinking's done for you. You know who's got the white hats, you know who's got the black hats, you know what's a very complicated problem that's not easy to deal with. You know what everybody knows, but politicians simply won't do because of this and that and the other thing. It's all thought out for you. It means when you're reading it or you're repeating it, you're not thinking. Watch out for it. Predigested thinking. It can also take place within ISKCON. There's so many things that everybody knows about who's off, who's on, who's dangerous, who's fringed out, who's solid, who's fired up, what's our main mission, what's has nothing to do with what we're supposed to be doing. Think about it yourself. Consult the authority yourself. Don't just buy it because everybody else says it's true. Look and see. Read our books. Be solid. If you read the books, then you're solid. Any questions further? Okay. Oh, I had one more example. A good one, pseudo-technical jargon. I had a friend who had a terminal disease and was therefore in the hospital instead of at his usual post as a big executive for the Xerox Corporation. And he told me a story about how he used to work, or his company used to do contract work for the United States Defense Department. And one of the selling points that this particular corporation had for its equipment was something called a geometrical amplifier. A geometrical amplifier. And whenever it came to a hard sell where they really had to tell why their opinion, while their stuff was superior, they'd always point to that geometrical amplifier, which would really amplify things. It turned out, one day he was thinking, he's a scientist, he was thinking, what does this geometrical amplifier do? How is it? He looked back at the original research and he found the graph was going on showing what the amplifier did. And then when you turn to the next page, it showed it really doing it, amplifying more and more. And when he looked at the two pages, he saw that this had been done with boxes this big and this had been done with boxes that big. The research guy had changed his standard, intentionally or unintentionally, so that you weren't graphing the same thing anymore. So your geometrical amplifier was in fact an ordinary garden variety linear amplifier. Standard old amplifier like all the competition had. That means the stupid Defense Department was bamboozled by the high-sounding geometrical amplifier. The man brought it to the attention of his superiors, and superiors dropped the note in the wastebasket and kept selling stuff to the good old Defense Department. The geometrical amplifier. So if you're working for the Department of Defending Krishna Consciousness, don't be bamboozled by geometrical amplifiers. Ask, what does it do? How do you know? What does it mean? How does it work? Explain it to even stupid old me so that I can understand it clearly. Okay. All good. Shubhatam.